Hello, everyone, and welcome back to RPG R&D. I am one of your hosts, Jess Geyer. I'm one half of Wannabe Games, and I make tabletop role-playing games, and Craig is making fun of me for my sing-song voice. Hi, Craig.
Hi, I was doing jazz hands. I'm Craig Campbell. I'm the owner of Nerdburger Games. I make tabletop role-playing games, too, as well as a card game. And we are here. This is... behind the scenes, we recorded two episodes today, and so if you heard the previous episode, that was Ethan, brand new guest, and we are back with another brand new first time, like, unspoiled by the weight of the world, not doesn't hate us yet, guest who is here with us, brand new person. Thank you, Lila. Welcome to the show.
Hi, my name is Lila Fujiwara. I'm a game designer and project lead. Sort of most flashily and notably, I'm the project lead for the Cosmere RPG, Brandon Sanderson's big role-playing game. I also lead adventure design for them. So if you play the Stonewalkers campaign adventure or the upcoming Mistborn Legacy campaign adventure, you'll be seeing some of my work in there. But I also have my own little game studio called Jar of Eyes Games and have made Jukebox, the tabletop musical TTRPG, which I hope we'll chat about a little bit today. So that is me.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming on the show. So good to see you. Yeah, we have a topic that I know a lot of people are interested in, nervous about, having perhaps nightmares about, which is getting into the industry specifically in the past 3 years. Things have changed a lot even since I got into the industry. And Lila, I'm curious about what made you choose this topic.
Yeah, well, maybe it was a little bit of like a... I pitched this topic in a way that feels like a little bit of like the snake eating itself, or Borealis or whatever, because I think that like one of the things when I was newer and trying to get into the industry, it's like, okay, well, I got to be known in some capacity. So I started a Substack, and I have a background in like teaching and making like online tutorials and stuff. So I immediately went towards like material about how I am getting started, because like I was getting started. I wasn't really an expert on, you know, anything, but I'm like, well, I'll do a kind of like case study of like my path, you know, getting into things. And so that required a lot of like thinking about what was working and what was I doing, and like, you know, and creating that in material that was both like a story about kind of what was happening with me, but also like sort of tutorial process of the things that I was doing and what I was researching and like talking to people. Like a lot of people gave me their time, and sort of I did like informational interview stuff and they'd give me tips and stuff. So anyways, it's a long way to say that like part of me getting started was thinking about how one gets started and sharing the things that I was learning. And so therefore I have like a little blog post series about it, and it is a bit fresh in my brain. And I think also like, I imagine that this is probably the experience that you all have had, but like, I got a lot of help. Like, you just don't, I think, make it without people taking chances on you, without people like teaching you things kind of informally or mentoring you. And so I think especially, so I quit my tech job and did a sort of career switch, quote unquote, in 2022, which is why at least for a little bit longer, we can say, you know, in the last 3 years. Yeah, so I got a lot of guidance and help when I was doing that. I have a very strong sense of like wanting to help other folks and sort of demystify getting into games, because we say 3 years ago, but let's say like 5 years ago, I would have never imagined that I'm doing the cool stuff that I get to do now. Like, it felt very out of reach and impossible.
I mean, even like 5 years ago, there was some stuff that was happening in the world that made it also very, very different.
Yeah, Craig. A lot of people got their start, though. Yeah.
No, that's okay. I find that the comment interesting, because I've said it, I've heard other people say it within the RPG industry. And then you also hear, you see interviews and things about it, where anybody who's in like a creative field usually has some sort of a story that's a variation of, there was this thing that I really loved, and then I kind of realized, oh, human beings do that. I'm a human being. I could do that. And you know, you hear stories of like, you know, the famous directors who like were 7 years old when they realized like making a movie is just a job. Like you can, my dad has a job. My mom has a job. All these people have jobs. I could have a job that is making movies. And that's, you know, that's the first step to getting into the industry is realizing that like, oh, you can do it. There's just, it's a question of finding the methods and figuring out how to do it. And there's infinite or near infinite, you know, infinity minus one ways to do it. So I think it's interesting to talk a little bit about what sort of methods and advice can be given for getting into the industry, in the last few years, because Lila, you said like Jess and I both have been around for a while, and you know, pre 3 years, 5 years ago. And so like our methods, while they may still work today, like we don't have the experience with some of the other things that you might do today, to kind of get your foot in the door. And that comes to, and this is, we're broadly talking about design, or, you know, if you want to, if you do artwork, or if, you know, and you want to do art, for a game, or you want to get involved in editing or consulting on some level, whatever that might be.
Yeah.
No, nobody wants to be a publisher.
Yeah, that's sort of an interesting, there might be.
Yes, and I publish because we have to.
Yeah, I think there is like a really interesting like thing to, so one of the ways that I got my foot in the door is via this like project management, project lead thing. Like part of my story is definitely that I had skills outside of the game design skills, which are like the writing and game design skills, I feel are like the sexy ones that everybody wants. It's a bit more competitive, like it's very subjective. And anyways, we could get into that. But I did want to jump off your statement of like, at some point you have this realization that, oh, it's a job and like people do this. And like, I could be a person who does this. And I think that like one tip or thought that I would give, or that the experience for me was going to conventions where people were playtesting their games. Because I think it's one thing to talk to somebody who's like doing it super professionally and you see the like, you know, final hardcover books or whatever. And I think for most people, myself included, that feels very unattainable, right? But if you go to a game where there's somebody who is, you know, playtesting their game on index cards or like, you know, very prototypey kind of stuff, and maybe they haven't figured out the rules yet kind of thing, I think it drives home like, oh, this intermediate process, like it doesn't just come out fully formed. Like there's a lot of work that goes on behind the scenes. And like, I can pick up a bunch of index cards and have like a printout sheet of paper of the, you know, rules that I came up with. So I think that for multiple reasons, going to events like that was very inspirational to me, just seeing that kind of like intermediate step. You also then meet people who are doing it and can talk to them. So I think that like, finding either online spaces or convention in-person spaces. I've been trying real hard to find a group locally that does like role-playing playtesting, but I have found a board game playtesting group, right? So, you know, I have too much on my plate, but if I wanted to make a board game, I would know how to make a board game now, and I know what I'm so I think that that is a real good, like just dipping your foot in the water. You know, if you play test somebody's role-playing game, and then you go, tell me about your game and tell me about like the way that you put this together or like how you started designing your stuff, they will probably be excited to tell you that. Like you just did them a favor playtesting their game, and then like it just gives you, you know, that insight into at least that person's journey and kind of like thought process around things.
Yeah, most people are really, really excited to talk about that. And I say most people, I guess most people that I've encountered have always been very willing to share their experiences and kind not like be a mentor, like in the very official kind of sense, but do some of that mentoring work for people who are interested in getting into games. We are, you know, despite the stereotypes against gamers, we're very social people. We like people. That's why we play role-playing games. And I've had a lot of great experiences playtesting people's games. My favorite place to go is first exposure or double exposure at a convention, and see what people are doing for playtesting. Lila, you were like, I have had the same experience where it's mostly board games. It's mostly board and card games. There's very few people I think that have organized RPG playtesting, unless it's like as a group. Mm-hmm. Individually, a lot. But as a group, organized playtesting for RPGs is rare.
So I definitely at GameholeCon met a like game design collective that's in Chicago. I actually asked around, I'm like, if you wanted to move somewhere to like find these communities or whatever, and I think that Chicago and Philly were like the two
Yes.
cities that were mentioned. So there is stuff out there. Talking about conventions, I don't know if this is like formalized, but Games on Demand is a community group that often runs at various conventions and hosts like games that you can kind of just jump into. And a lot of times that'll have folks who are playtesting. So if you're looking for some at first exposure, is that prime? I think that's all board games, right?
It's
Or
all board. It's like pretty much all board games. I have seen people do role playing games up
okay.
there. I have seen that. Yeah, and games on demand. Yeah, definitely. In Chicago, we do an indie games on demand, and a lot of people bring their RPGs there too. They're playtesting ones, especially because we explicitly make it open for people to want to do that.
I know of at least one Discord server like playtest community. So there are, I think it's called Session Zero. You can look into it. But there's definitely some amount of like online, playtesting communities, which obviously like cut down some barriers of you not being like physically close maybe to a bunch of people that want to playtest. So I think that those are all kind of options or things that people could look into. I would definitely say like, if you're in a more major city, look, see, I think the board game playtesting group that I found is on Meetup. Like it advertises on meetup.com. So there are ways that you could just Google like playtesting group in my area and you might be able to find something. And then conventions are obviously spaces that do this, and then there are online communities that playtest.
But what you're doing there too, when you join those places, or when you build your own, you're building a network of those people who can then help you make other connections with those people who can get you into game design and all of that. Like it's very interesting. Like when, like thinking back about when I first got into game design, the people who I met who were in that playtesting phase or were like just push publishing your first thing, and how big they are now, like the resources that they have, the connections that they've made, and like that's part of my network, that those early experiences were super, super important for me.
Yeah, I'm trying to. It's definitely a team sport, and you like, I don't know. It my brain is trying to think about different ways to divide this up, right? Because I think like, what does getting into the industry mean? There's a couple of different archetypes that you could go off after, I guess. And I think one of the big sort of path splits is, are you somebody who wants to be publishing your own stuff, putting out Kickstarters, maybe starting with some zines and stuff, and like, being known as a game designer that makes their own things and you are the full publisher for yourself. Yeah, there's gonna be a lot of extra stuff attached to this. Or is your goal to freelance for, Darrington Press and Wizards of the Coast, and like you want to, get your work into, these pre-established like, companies and kind of stuff. And the while there is a little bit of overlap, like the skill set of the paths and kind of how you approach things, I think for those are different. And then I think we also touched on the fact that like, getting into the industry doesn't necessarily mean that a lot of people want to write, but like, there are ways that you can do a combination of things. Like the industry is in need of really skilled editors. It is in desperate need of folks who know how to do layout, especially if you know how to do like print layout stuff. The sort of project management skills, like, man, I think my job was a lot easier coming at it from the project management. Like there were some larger companies that were willing to talk to me because I was coming at it from like a project lead people organization angle. Like one of the folks who's currently writing for us like got her start doing sort of customer service like stuff and customer rep stuff for I think Roll 20 or Drive Through, that amalgamation of stuff. So like if you know how to market, if you know how to like community manage and things, I hesitate to say like, oh, really focus on this. If you want a game design, like focus on this like side path. I don't know if I would tell somebody necessarily like, oh, try to get editor skills so that you can eventually be writing, although I don't think that's the worst like bit of advice. But I do think that, like, you know, I think, again, people, whenever you are looking at sort of like an industry from the outside, like, you don't know what the day-to-day work is like, mm-hmm. don't know what it takes to get into it, and you will have preconceived notions. And like, maybe you don't like writing and you don't know it until you like sort of start doing it, you start meeting people who do it. And maybe you really like editing, or maybe you really like layout. I think the thing that I'm just trying to say is, like, a lot of times I think that people latch on to the, like, the shiny, like, most public facing stuff, when there's a lot of other stuff that goes on behind the scenes, including things that might be even of more interest to you, or that you have, like, a particular, you know, talent with, which is why, besides going to, like, you know, conventions and stuff, I think, like, the informational interview, which we've kind of, like, touched on, or just, like, finding people who are willing to give you 30 minutes to an hour of their time, you know, like, chat about what their life is like, and, like, how they got where they are, and, like, you know, what they do day to day, is a really sort of, like, powerful thing. And I know that I've definitely, like, done a lot of that. I'm going to keep talking for a little bit longer, but I think one of the things when you are thinking about asking for somebody's time to chat with you is always go into that chat, like, with a list of questions. I think that the more kind of, just go into that conversation being ready to, like, guide the conversation a little bit and know what you want to get out of it. You know, if it's exploratory, that's fine, but, you know, make sure that you come with some goals for what you want to get out of the conversation. If you're a little bit farther along in kind of your path, a lot of times I've used sort of these informational interviews if I am embarking on a particular project and I just need, like, I'm doing my first Kickstarter, you've done 5 Kickstarters, tell me X, Y, like, I go in, it's very clear that I've done the amount of research that one can do with, like, you know, a day worth of reading, like, blog posts and looking up things. And then I come in with, like, a list of questions, you know, based off of that, if I'm trying to do, like, a specific task.
Right. And if you don't know what all of those questions are going to be, you probably know what some of them are, but you may not know what all the questions might need to be. You know, there's nothing wrong with just, like, having some casual conversations with some people who are doing some of the things that you're interested in doing, just to start to get a sense of what it really is like, and to set those those preconceived notions aside. And then you start to develop a little more in the way of questions about what you can ask, you know, what you can ask somebody when you get a chance to sit down and kind of pick somebody's brain, whether that be in person or online at a convention, whatever. To speak to building relationships, because a lot of what we do in RPG in the industry is built off of developing relationships to begin with, and then kind of maintaining those and building those and growing those. Is that when if you get like I'm going to go and have lunch with this designer who is cool to sit down and chit chat with me for half an hour, be respectful of their time, be respectful of what they're, you know, what they're available to give. Like, ask them the questions you want to ask. Don't try to get them to stay longer. Don't, you know, ask them to speculate or trash talk, or, you know, like, don't get sensationalist and, you know, like, you know, stick to, like, trying to kind of be professional and, like, just find the information that you need, rather than, because I know, don't get me wrong, I've been in rooms with longtime game designers, publishers, and so forth, telling me this, you know, spilling the tea, as it were, like, telling me how this thing happened or how this failure took place at this company, or, you know, that's fun for hanging around and just chit chatting and everything. But if you've got a goal in mind, kind of make sure you know where you're going with all of that. And there's a lot to be said for just getting, just starting a little bit of a relationship with some people that are interested. You know, be a fan of their work, or be intrigued by it in some way that you want to learn more if you don't know that much. And that genuine kind of interest in the thing will show through, and people will be like, oh, this is the person that is really genuinely interested. They have good questions. Now they feel like their time's not being wasted, which is also, you know, being respectful of the time of the person that you're asking for to walk through all of this for you. And, you know, like, all the stuff we've been talking about can turn into the typical things, like, you know, networking, and, like, you know, like, that's the term for it. But it's that can seem daunting, where it's like, really, it's just talking to people, being respectful, treating people like peers, and asking questions and offering the information that you have when you're asked, when you do have some knowledge or expertise in something. And to speak to Lila's comment too about like not wanting to tell people, well, if you want to write, you should get into community management, and then like sideways your way in. Just there's plenty of people that have done that. There's lots and lots of people who work in the industry who do write and design work, who also do this other thing. And they may have done that. You know, a lot of them have done that other thing first. That's like the thing that they got in there, because it also gets you into a position where now you've got some responsibility. You're doing a thing. People are noticing.
Yep.
Oh, hey, you know, Lila's really good at doing this thing.
And is responsible and makes deadlines and isn't going to be mean to everyone around.
And on top of it is very, dedicated and, you know, passionate about games. And so like, yeah, here we go, writing assignment time, and boom, there you go. You're off to your first freelance writing gig. That's not to say that you can't just set your sights on the thing it is you want to do and just hard down push for that too. But it's, you hear some people say this sort of thing with like music or actors or whatever, where it's like, this is something you would do even if you weren't getting paid. This is something you would do even if you're, you know, you're not getting the exposure or acclaim or something that goes along with it. Even if nobody knows who you are, like if people who are in the industry, if I talk to you long enough, I can figure out, yeah, that's the type of person you are. Like, this is something you really need to do and really want to do. And that means, that makes me like think, okay, I feel safe hiring this person as a freelancer. I've told the story on the podcast before, but there's a reason Beth Varney got so much illustration work for Nürburgring Games. Because when I first went looking for artists for Mergers and Acquisitions, I got a lot of people coming back like, oh, hey, I'd love to do work on your game. Here's my portfolio. And that's all they ever sent me. Beth gave me a whole rundown of why she really wants to do tabletop role-playing games, who her favorite tabletop role-playing game artist is, and why, and how they would like, you know, how she would like to, you know, do the, not necessarily the artwork style or whatever of that person, but like, you know, the lessons she's learned and like why she pursues things the way she does is because this other person does. And you'll pick up on that. So, you know, it's gaming industry is full of a bunch of creative type people, and creative type people talk about emotions and loves and needs and wants. And, you know, so be forthright about that. Be like right up front and say, you know, I'd love to do, you know, help you out with this thing, but at some point I'd love to try this other thing. Or maybe you just want to say like, this is the only thing I'm really interested in. And I really, really want to do it. And here's an example of something I wrote for myself because I just had to do it, because I would do it even if I wasn't being paid.
Yeah. There's a couple of things. The, I would do it if I wasn't even being paid, I think is a very double-edged sword in probably all artistic industries. Mm-hmm. Because if you do things without being paid, in our capitalist society, you might be on the path to putting yourself in kind of an unsustainable, you know, situation. I think it is very valid to have a day job and, you know, create art and, you know, if you want to give it away for free or however you want to conduct yourself, like that's fine. But I think that like, if you are looking to make this an actual career, there's going to be a reckoning that you need to have about like getting paid for your work.
Oh, and absolutely. Don't do other work for people.
Yeah, without absolutely. Payment. Don't do other work for other people for free. And even when you're doing work for yourself, like I had a, you know, I mentioned that I have a blog series that I'll plug at the end of this. But one of the things that I was saying was like, I think it is okay. I don't know. It feels kind of icky, to engage with like, oh, you know, selling artwork sometimes and try to like figure out how much stuff is worth. And I think people have a lot of imposter syndrome and just like hangups around it. But like, I don't know. I encourage people to sell their stuff, like to give it a price and make it something that is worth people paying money for. Like, have faith that it is worth somebody paying, it was worth your time, and they are going to derive an experience out of this for the like 2 to 4 hours if it's like a one shot or something that was worth paying money for. And if it's not worth paying money for it, then maybe you need to be working on the skills and stuff to make it something that you can feel like, you know, I am, this is worth $5 or whatever for like a afternoon for folks. Gosh, there was another, yeah. So the other point about like kind of coming into it from a, you know, getting maybe some other job, but being interested in the game design stuff and kind of talking about this. So I heard this when I was like applying to places or like trying to freelance. Now, as somebody who occasionally makes hiring decisions, it's like very high on my mind. But they say like, if you have somebody working for you, there's kind of like three things. There's, are they like, do they produce wonderful, transcendent, like great work? Like, are they actually like a good, you know, artist kind of thing? There is, are they, do they get stuff done on time? Are they, you know, communicative? Like, you know, can you kind of rely on them? And then there is the, do you enjoy working with them? Are they a decent human being? Like, are you having fun having conversations with them? Or are they somebody who's really argumentative and you like sort of dread interacting with them kind of thing? And as a person who's hiring, generally, if you have two of those, like you will continue to get work. And if you have three, then you're a triple threat and like, you know, things are going well. So I think to Craig's point of like, you can get hired somebody somewhere as like a marketing person or whatever, you have the ability to just display two of those things. You have the ability to display that you are a solid worker and that you are like enjoyable and good to work with. Kind of, like you get stuff done on time, you're communicative, like you get display all those skills. And then really the only quote unquote risk that they're taking on you is the, you know, game design skill or that, you know, sort of thing.
Yeah. No, yeah, people really like you said at the beginning, like that is the subjective skill, that the writing, the game design, that's really, really subjective. There's not really a good way to judge that unless you've already like had stuff published. If you're brand new, you don't have much of a portfolio to speak of. The way that you're going to get a gig doing that writing work is not by showing them that you are a good writer a lot of the time. It's by showing them that you are a passionate person, getting them to like you, not in in a fake way, because people can smell, they can smell that from a mile away if you're being fake, but like being like, like this is a cool person, I like their ideas, I've talked to them about games. Everybody has like, every human has the capacity to be creative, and like if it's subjective anyway, people are more likely to hire people that they have seen that passion from and enjoy the time with, which is like the basis of what we're saying here, which is how I've gotten like most of my freelance gigs. Like, oh, you actually read my work. You just think I'm kind of cool and you want to give me a job. Like, that's fine. I'll write you something really good.
Yeah, I think, and I actually want to take a step back, because I think of the phase that you were trying to like convince people to hire, we've taken a couple steps forward from like, So before worrying about, I think there's I would say step zero is kind of like, understand a little bit about the industry, like understand a little bit about how things work. This is the kind of like, go find some playtesting communities and play some playtests, meet a couple people. But again, you're not asking them for anything. You might be like having a casual conversation about like how they got where they are, you know, expressing interest and stuff. And then the next thing that you really need to do is make something. Whatever it is that you were interested in, do the minimum viable product for the thing that you are, you know, trying to do. I think it's still, the organization definitely exists still. I direct a lot of people to the Storytelling Collective, which is a website that does like online courses to get people into, their bread and butter was like D&D adventure writing, but they've expanded out beyond that. The first thing that I ever published was via a 1 month course with them, which was called Write Your First Encounter. I had actually taken some other courses with them when I was still working about writing a whole adventure. And I had the early conception of like Jukebox in my head, and it was just too much and I couldn't do it. So the first thing that I ever did was like a one pager with them. There's a lot of power in just getting something done, getting something through all parts of the process, And before anybody is going to take you seriously, you need some minimal amount of a portfolio, in my humble opinion. Like, there's a lot of difference between somebody who comes up to me and says, "Hey, I want to get into game design," and they have not published anything. It's like there's people who say, "I want to get into game design," have a, maybe like have homebrewed some stuff, but can't like show me anything. One step up from that is that they've put it together enough and put it into a Google Drive folder, so at least I can like see the thing that they're talking about. And then I think when you're in a more solid place is when you've actually put something up on like DriveThruRPG, DMs Guild, Itch, and you have like a simple like online portfolio. So I'd be curious to see if you all disagree with this, but my strong statement is if you are serious about trying to get work or trying to like kickstart something, you are going to need a minimal portfolio site about who you are or what you do. You are going to need a couple of games that, things that you have put out there. And they do not need to be big. They can literally be like a collection of over 3 months, you have made 10 one-page encounters. Awesome. Like, I love to see that. In fact, I'd love to read the best one of yours that you've done, like, as a sample. So it does not need to be big, but you do need to put something up. And I would say that do that first or be in the process of doing that before you get too in your head about like trying to pitch people about hiring you or making friends to do anything, because people will also sense if you are doing the work, if that makes sense. And I think that there's plenty of people who idealize and are really excited about game design as a concept, but who are not actually doing the work, if that makes sense.
I 100% agree with what you, I when I, when my husband and I we're game design partners. When we decided we wanted to start making games, the thing we started doing was making games. We sat down on a Twitch stream, we designed a game in 1 hour. We did that several times until we had a lot of little games. We kind of knew what we liked to design. We knew how we worked together as designers. We had a little tiny portfolio of games, but we were also self-publishing indie authors. We didn't need to prove to anybody else other than ourselves and our audience what we could do. But it was helpful to have that when we were advertising our first actual published game to see, like, hey, look, here's us. You can go learn about us and what our values are. Even when, because my first ever TTRPG, like writing freelance gig, was with a friend who was making games and was already kind of an established game designer. Even they wanted me to send in a writing sample. So I needed a writing sample. They needed to make sure that I could put a sentence together. They weren't like digging into it, looking too deeply into the creativity. They knew me. They knew I was passionate about it. They just really needed to see that I could put words on a page. I can write. I can send that in. If you are trying to pitch yourself to, oh my gosh, okay, so I also have done. I got a connection from a friend to work for a major studio to do some freelance work. They also will need, they'll need more from you. They need to have a, they need a more established, because that they are paying you more money. They have bigger deadlines. More people are relying on them. Depending on the scale, and you're gonna probably start at that lower end, probably. But the higher up you get on the scale of like how, I don't want to use the word professional, because I think everybody within that level is perfect. Like everyone is being a professional here, but like the level of inner workings, clockwork of the industry, the more advanced that is, the more robust your portfolio does need to be,
And
usually.
the scale of it, I guess.
That's the word I was looking for. Yes, scale.
One of the things, oh, my brain, it is farting. Please unfart. There was something that you said that I latched onto, and I was gonna, what were you talking about? You were talking about getting gigs, needing a portfolio. It's gone.
It's okay. Maybe it'll come to
Yeah.
you.
Yeah, you are going to need a portfolio. Oh, all right. So the thing I was going to say is that the hard part is not writing the game. Like, there are hard parts and stuff associated to it, but that is not the hard part. The hardest part is getting people to play your game, which is kind of like the sad, you know, truth of it. Yeah. At least in the beginning, you know, I would say. So if you are struggling with writing the game in the first place, like, that, or maybe what I should say is, writing the game is the thing you have the most control over. Like, you have full control over whether you produce a game. You have full control over whether you make a portfolio site. You do not have full control over whether anybody plays it or, you know, it's popular or anything like that. But at least you have control over the ability to produce stuff. So, you know, do what you can do, which is like the making of the game kind of thing. And then getting other people to play the game also comes in with this... the other part of it, which is like making a game is a lot more than having a good idea, playtesting it, and like writing things in a Google Doc. I mean, that is making a game. But usually the parts that get people to play it are like, I need a layout, I need art, like I need to do some amount of like self-marketing. I might want to bring this thing to Kickstarter. There's all that other stuff, which essentially is the like tax you have to pay to get people to know about your game and maybe play your game, the less exciting stuff. That's all good to do if, you know, but worry about making the game first. And then you probably also want to think about all that other stuff because you probably want people to play your game. Yeah, I mean, there's tons more that I could say, but a lot of it I've written up in if you go to www.jarofeyes.com, you'll find my website. You can click on the newsletter. There's a full tutorial series. I think the short thing that I will say is the thing that worked for me is I started becoming the person that was organizing people to make games. So I made little teams of people that made games. And I think once you've done something kind of solo or sort of figured things out on your own, getting involved in group projects is kind of the next step after that that you want to do before people are going to like formally hire you. And if you are at a point that like that nobody's going to invite you to a group, make the group yourself. And that's essentially like what the little tutorial series is. It's like, how do you find people, you know, a bunch of templates and stuff for coordinating them. And the other pitch that I will just make for that, and the thing that ultimately ended up working out for me, is that when you work on these little group projects, which can be, you can, if you're worried about paying people, you can do like royalty split stuff when you're just starting out, and that's fully described. But when you do these group projects, everybody who works on the group project gets a sense for what you are like as a designer, and the other attributes are you fun to work with, and do you get your shit done on time? And if you do a group project with like five other people and one of them makes it, like if you, maybe even if you're not the one who makes it, but somebody else makes it and they liked working with you, like they are, you know, rising tide raises all ships, and they will, you know, raise your ship. By the way, there's a community called the Rising Tide, which is a community for people who are trying to get into TTRPGs and like supporting each other. So another a Discord server that I like highly recommend anybody trying to get into the industry looks at. So that's my like last lengthy pitch that we didn't get full time to talk about, but yeah.
Let's talk about game design a little bit. Okay, you want to start making games. You want to make a really cool game. You want to make a game with a non-traditional mechanic. You don't want to use dice. You don't want to use cards. That's old. Let's do the weird stuff. It's an RPG where you're, I don't know, playing with Jell-O. Who knows?
Yeah, remember everybody, there was a time before Dread.
Yes.
There
oh
was
my
a
gosh,
time
yes.
before 10 Candles. There was a time before, like anytime there's been a game that's been kind of non-traditional in any way, there's a time before Alice is Missing. When, you know, there were games that kind of introduced a thing that can be used to make a game. And in this case, we're talking about mechanics. Yeah.
Yeah. So, well,
no, Lila, you have what? Some experience with this.
Please.
I brought this up because I would say that the one game that I've designed fully, which is Jukebox, is, at the heart of it is a non-traditional mechanic, which is I knew that I wanted people singing karaoke during the game, and I wanted it to work as a game. And so, you know, I did a little bit of a thought experiment and, you know, over the years of designing it, like learned some things about how to design a game with like a non-traditional mechanic at the middle of it. And that's why I brought it up. So I can chat about that. I also like, I'm a sucker for a gimmick. Like I love, you know, if I'm going to spend 4 hours playing a one shot, I would love to be doing something bizarre, you know, that I've never thought about, during that, one shot. So I won't say like I'm the absolute expert on making like 10 games with non-traditional mechanics, but I've made one and I love it. And I would love to just spend the next 30 minutes or whatever chatting about it. Can I ask a question of the two of you?
Yeah,
sure.
Do you all have some games with non-traditional mechanics that like Craig just listed off a bunch, including some that are on my list right here. But I'm curious if there's what do people love?
I've only created one thing that I would consider non-traditional mechanic, which is it was just a one page game idea that I had. I wrote it up. I gave it away to some people years and years ago. I've got a copy. I've got it sitting somewhere called Cthulhu, which is Cthulhu. It was the idea of you basically play a Cthulhu game where you all have player, you know, you all come up with a character. There's no character sheets or anything. You just decide what your character is, and you pass the story around from person to person, and you tell a Cthulhu style story. But every time you tell the Cthulhu, when it comes to your turn, like the first person has to invent a weird ancient language word or title or something that's part of the mythos of this game, and you have to use that when you talk, and then you pass the story to the next person, and when it's their turn, they have to refer to that and pronounce it correctly the way you did, and then add one and, you know, one weird made up word, and you keep going like that. And so by the time you get to like the fifth or sixth person, they have to repeat five weird words. And as you go along, some of those will get ingrained into your head because you hear them so many times, but there's always new stuff, right? So, and then when you screw it up, everybody at the table, you know, by consensus agrees, okay, you mispronounced that, you gain like an insanity, you know, you lose a sanity point or whatever, you know, whatever it is going to be that's going to take you out. Or you could have a countdown to, you know, if you gain 3 points, then the Hounds of Tyndalos find you and kill you. whatever. I don't remember. I don't think I called it sanity points, but something akin to that. Like, well, it's the spiral of like, you know, dealing with these horrible things. And so it was a memory based. It was using memory as a mechanic, not suited to every player. Some players are going to have a very hard time with that. Just the same way there are certain players won't enjoy Jenga because fine motor control might be an issue for them. But, you know, weird mechanic. And then one I know of that I really dig is, again, it's built in narrative, which is Psychic Trash.
I played it.
Psychic Trash Detectives.
Yeah, very bizarre.
Where the narrative is, you know, working out a mystery. These detectives, you're solving the mystery, and then in the end, you ultimately take the contents, like a certain number of things, you pull out of the contents out of a garbage can, and those items have to become part of the story of the mystery.
Yeah,
that you're solving. And so like, it just depends on where you are, whose house you're in, or what, you know, venue you're at, and what might be in the garbage. So it makes for very, very different stories every time, because like everybody's dark garbage, like who knows what could be, like it could be anything. Like
I was going to bring up, Psychic Trash Detectives too, because that is like, ooh, that's a little fun, cute thing. You're bringing it in from your environment. Another one I know. Oh,
you're raccoons in the game. You're raccoons.
Right.
That's why I almost said psychic trash pandas.
Yeah.
You're like a little, you're like vermin creatures that are digging through the trash.
I yeah. played this, at one of the last cons that I went to. So yeah.
Well, and those games are the best because they can, like, the mechanic is so thematic. Like, okay, you're little raccoons and it's trash. Like, there we go. I love that. There's another, it's another very short game. It's a one-page RPG by Julian Kay called Faith and Sails, where you are sailors on a doomed ship, and you're literally, yes, exactly.
I'm just, like, looking at my shelf. Sorry, I'm for
Lila just showed us a copy of it.
Yeah, I have a copy of it.
Yeah, you're dropping dice into a glass of water, and that is the mechanic. I love when things like that are like so heavily thematic on things that are unique in a way that aren't like in terms of they're not dice or cards. I've seen several games that have come through the Indie Games Day that we do in at my local game store that use dominoes, and I have not had a chance to play any of them, and I'm very, very interested in seeing how those play, and I wish I could name any of them, but I have not sat down at the table to do them. I thought I had a picture of one in my phone. I thought I had snapped a photo, but I cannot find it. And I think that there's a lot of interesting stuff out there that is also just like the way that we use language, or like, you know, like you had mentioned earlier, Craig, like Alice is missing. Yes, Alice is missing. Sorry, I was thinking there's a podcast called Alice Isn't Dead, and I always want to say that for the TTRPG. it's about your communication and how that's working. A lot of people are doing some very interesting stuff. But there's something that you mentioned too, Lila, that like a lot of these games are in the one-shot framework. Like, you're not doing this as a sustainable campaign. And I'd be really interested to see one of these unique mechanics come out and help you form a game that's more robust and can do more stuff.
So I might be talking about something that none of us know deeply about, but I played Shadow Dark in one of the conventions that I played recently, which I feel like has been getting a big, like a lot of people are really excited about Shadow Dark. And that includes a timer, which I would consider as a pretty interesting and very thematic, because it's like when your torch goes out, and Shadow Dark definitely has like a, well, the one game I played of it, you know, has a kind of like horror, oh gosh, the lights are out, you know, sort of thing. And I would posit that as a non-traditional mechanic. And I think it is something that could be played in campaign play, because it's a, you know, I believe, you know, OSRE derived sort of D&D-esque, you know, kind of thing. Either you played any Shadow Dark?
I have not.
Right, well, maybe homework assignment for us all. But I think the mechanic, I think that's an interesting thing to think about. Like, because oftentimes with a one-shot, it's very focused on giving you a particular experience and like saying something about it in 2 to 4 hours. And there's not enough there for it to, you know, go over, you know, games and games and games and games and games. Jukebox, which is the karaoke singing game. I don't think I could really imagine like a campaign play mode. It is meant to like wrap up, you know, in one go. But I don't think it's impossible to make a game that like, you know, is using something besides cards or dice.
I think having a very, very robust game that can, you know, involve character advancement and lots of ranges of threats and long campaigns and multiple sessions and all that, the thing that and have that game have something other than dice or playing cards being used as the mechanic, I think the reason we don't have a whole bunch of those is that they're a hard sell.
Yeah.
You know, the gamers are going to be like, I like rolling my shiny, you know, clicky clacks. I'll play the playing card game once in a while because it's cool. And we play poker when we do it, or blackjack or whatever. Right. But you know, it's as a one shot, I have to dig through the trash. Like, you know, that's perfect. Don't get me wrong. I think there's the potential for it out there, because the gaming community has only gotten larger and larger over the last decade or so. And so there is a subset audience in there that would be like, I would totally be down for a long campaign of a game that used this weird, you know, a mechanic. But it is a harder sell. And that's coming from me, the kind of guy that got started, you know, over 30 years ago, where playing cards were like, whoa, when Deadlands had playing cards and poker chips in it. The audience is probably stronger for something like that now than it was some time ago. So maybe we'll start seeing some of those.
Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to like a couple thoughts. One, if it's a campaign, you're just like signing up for so much more of a commitment. Yeah. I think that like a lot of these games feel like they have like an almost experimental quality to them. You know what I mean? Yeah. So, and they probably are in some sense. I mean, you know, it's, and I guess the other half of that is when you're thinking about designing a game, like I know for me, the idea of, you know, I was talking about minimum viable product for like when you're just trying to get started. I think that's wise in any development journey. Like, even if maybe your end goal is to design some sort of campaign based thing, like, you sure as heck got to get the, you know, one session, you know, thing down for that. Like, even if somebody was trying to design something that's going to run for 10 sessions or, you know, 100 or whatever, like, step number one is make sure that you got something good for one session. And the stakes are just lower, I think, like, if you are trying to create, I don't know, like, one of the things I was going to say with designing Jukebox is, like, figuring out what the game's goals are, really, like, North Star focused on it. And I think that when you are designing, it's a lot easier to be like, I'm just going to focus on making a really killer, like, 4-hour experience, as opposed to getting swept away with like, oh, I have to make this game that's going to be like enjoyable for like 100 hours of gameplay or something like that. So speaking at it from a more design perspective, I think it's probably wise to be thinking about like, what, let me crystallize what I want all my players to like experience in a shorter amount of time. And then you might discover that maybe it's something that could work for campaign play.
You could build it small. Start by building it small, but kind of keep in mind where those nooks and crannies are, where you could expand it into something bigger and more robust if it kind of starts to get a following or people get interested in the idea.
I think there's also a specificity with these mechanics. Like, Jukebox is much more specific in some ways than D&D. Like, Broadway musicals is much more specific than the wide world of like things that you could do with a D20 system. Psychic trash detectives, like, how much, what are the variety of stories that you can tell about a raccoon detective touching trash? Like, that's a little bit more narrow, I feel like, than, you know, D&D, basically. So I think there's a little bit that, like, and, you know, Faith in Sails, which I haven't played it, but, you know, it's you're talking about ships and you have dice dropping into the water. Like, that is a very specific experience. You're probably not going to be playing like a, I don't know, rom-com game with that, because the mechanic is so tailored for the story that you're trying to tell.
Can you kind of walk through, because a game where you're singing songs and you're doing karaoke, how did you walk through the design process to make sure that, yes, you're using this unique mechanic in a way that the players are going to be able to tell a story with? Because that is the trick to using a unique mechanic.
Yeah. So I'm going to start telling this story. We'll see how long it is. But I came up with the idea for Jukebox, I want to say it was before the pandemic, and I was headed into a like a Korean Japanese style, like, karaoke studio. So they have these rent a room kind of like karaoke places that you could go to. It's a more sort of like Asian style karaoke, and you get a room with your friends. You have it for like 3 or 4 hours and you have a blast singing karaoke. And I was like, wouldn't it be cool to give myself the challenge of designing a game that's like meant to be played in this, you know, environment. So that was sort of the seed of it. Then I took Design Your First Adventure with the Storytelling Collective, which is this kind of like online course thing. And I was like, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to make the D&D version of like the musical episode of your campaign. and I spent a long time trying to figure out how that would work. I like watched the Buffy musical episode. It was like kind of breaking apart what stuff was going on there. After a lot of playtesting, I came to the conclusion that like the mechanics of D&D and this like song singing, you know, sort of just what you're talking about, with the songs being the center of like the narrative, like they just didn't, there was nothing about them that like cohesed or wove together. Like running a D&D combat doth not like support breaking out into song. I mean, certainly if somebody else out on the internet finds out how they can get that to work, let me know. I'd be very curious. And then I briefly tried like a dungeon world hack, because I'm like, oh, maybe the system just needs to be simpler. I tried Powered by the Apocalypse. I was trying very hard not to fall into the trap of designing my own game system from scratch and having something where I could just like hack another system. And after playtests of doing this, I realized that like the issue was that all of these external mechanics were just like not supporting the core of like my game. Taking a step back, because eventually I would come up with a list of like goals and North Stars, which I can share. But I think the first thing that was in my head was like, I know the experience that I get when I'm at a really good musical and somebody breaks out into song, and I have a very like, and I've been in karaoke rooms, and I just know when like you got a friend who's really into it, and it's like a musical that there's this like particular moment where like it's a storytelling climax, I guess. And I'm like, that is what I want to happen. Like, I have a scene in my head of what my game is going to look like when it is being done well, and so I will know it when I see it, kind of thing. And then later, that would, after a lot of play testing, like backtrack into to goals. So I guess from all of that, what I will say is that the thing that I learned was that like just slap it on random mechanics to it past the like the fact that you're like singing a song was not the appropriate way for me to figure out how to get there. Like, less is more. And I ended up taking inspiration from story games. So I don't know if we kind of danced around it, but like, are you all familiar with the game Follow, Fiasco, kind of as three? There's a lot of these games with sort of like three act structures and like scene games. So that's the structure that we've got.
Fiasco, sure. I'll that those are yep.
Yeah, Fiasco, Follow, Dialect, and Downfall. All wonderful games. People look into them, but those were games that I, kind of took inspiration from. So I knew one of the first like goals that I put down for Jukebox was that you were gonna. So when I was trying to encapsulate what does it mean when I that moment in a musical when they're like everything is really coming together or like in a karaoke studio, the sentence that I wrote down was sing big dramatic karaoke songs and for those songs to be the bones of the story that you tell. Because another big part of it is I didn't want some story going on and then you sing a completely unrelated like karaoke song. So that I at least knew was a goal. And there's probably a couple of like other middle steps that I can talk about that we try that I tried before getting to where I ended up getting. But the mechanic right now is that at the beginning of the game, there's a bunch of other stuff that goes on during the game, but at the beginning of the game, you write down on some index cards. On each index card, you write down a song that you would enjoy singing as a karaoke song. This in itself was a very thought out thing through playtesting because people don't want to sing karaoke songs that they don't know. So
Right.
there was some like part of the mechanic that was like you were never going to be told to sing a karaoke song that like somebody else tells you to sing or like. And the other thing that I discovered in playtesting is that if you go to somebody, hey, think of karaoke. So well, actually, so an early version of Jukebox was like during the game, you would be on the spot to think up of a really clever karaoke song, which explains like what happens next in the story. And speaking of like weird things that people are good at, kind of with the Jenga tower, like shaky hands or whatever, there are some people who are very good at that skill of like coming up with the perfect karaoke song. But I would say 90% of the population just gets deer in the headlights and sits there for 10 minutes trying to think of the like perfect, like, whatever. And it slows the game to like a halt. So, that was kind of an intermediate, like my first idea was like, oh, people will just pitch karaoke songs for like what happens next in the story. Did not work. So what it is right now is that you, without thinking about what the story is going to be, you just put down karaoke songs that you would have a blast singing. And they're on one side of an index card, and you shuffle up the index cards. And as the story plays out through different acts and things, there's always a karaoke song that is at the center of a scene. This is like, one of the other things I want to say is like I was definitely inspired by like other games that I brought up. And Dialect, I can think of as what, like a clear one of this. Dialect is a game where you the scenes are all about language and like words that come up, kind of like the Cthulhu game that you were describing. Like people come up with a word, and that's like the nugget in the center of the scene. So I was like, oh, I could do something like that, but the karaoke song is like the center of the scene. Essentially, what happens is when you are talking about what is going to happen next in the story, all of the other players, besides the player who's about to have their, big scene or whatever, ask that player a question about what happens next in the story. So they might go like, I don't know, like, how does Bob react to the fact that like he fails his math test? And another person might be like, how does Bob react to or like, how does Bob cheat on his math test might be like another, you know, question. So they ask these kind of saucy questions that move the story forward and like get at something that they're interested in. And then the person flips over the index card, which has a song on it, and they decide which of the various questions presented to them that song answers. And so there's a bit of improvisation and like a moment of surprise because you don't know what's going to come up. And you have to like improv how this moves the story forward and how it answers one of the questions. You have the other players involved because they ask the questions. So they're very, you know, curious about how you're going to, you know, kind of put this together. And just built into the structure of the game, like the song has to answer an interesting question. And it is the nugget of the scene. Because if you think about like narrative structure of things, like a lot of times, you know, you have narrative questions that drive things. You want to know the answer to something. Jukebox uses this a lot. Like the whole story of Jukebox, you have a group goal that's phrased as a question. And when you answer the question, like the story is over. And then each scene has like a question in it. You guys have probably heard the phrase of like play to find out. And, you know, I am just proposing the questions that we are playing through to find out. It was unclear to me whether that was going to work, but in playtesting, always somebody gets something to work out. And sometimes the song that comes up is just so perfect that it feels like fate is doing something. It's just so clear what question that song, answers. So it's probably a bit rambly, but there's a couple things in there, but that structure of kind of question asking and knowing just enough about that you're going to have these songs, but you don't know what order they're going to come up in. And the extra chaos of like your friends asking you questions, like ended up with like 95% people are, you know, the scenes work out and people are having a good time.
It sounds like when you are trying something new or weird with your mechanics, playtesting is really important.
Yeah.
We know that dice work. We've played plenty of games. We know that cards work. There's plenty of games with cards. Does the pushing Jell-O around on your plate with a spoon mechanic work? You know, you gotta actually do a couple test cases before you say, yeah, that works. Yeah, I remember when Jukebox came out and I was like, I want a karaoke TTRPG. Like, I want this. I guess it's not even really, it's like not even fully a TTRPG. It's like pseudo LARP in a way. So I think I want more people to do stuff like that. Like, that's an interest. Like, I love the experience of a private room karaoke. What are things in our lives as game designers that we can draw upon? I love baking bread. Could I make that into an RPG? Not everything needs to be an RPG, but could you do these things? Like, I think that is like, when you start thinking of those questions as a game designer, 9 times out of 10, that's going to end up being like a game or at least a half-baked game in your notebook, you know?
or an idea or something kind of related to that you put on the shelf and it becomes, you take that idea and integrate that into some other thing down the road when you're like, oh, wait a minute, this thing that I came up with is perfect here, even if you're not pulling the mechanic itself, even if, racing frogs is not a good mechanic. Maybe something came out of the discussion about using the racing frogs mechanic that sparked something else.
I can't believe that you're dissing my racing frogs game, Craig.
I am.
I think also just opening the design space, like past cards and dice, is just a very good thing to keep the brain limber, if that makes sense. Like, you just have a whole bunch of other sort of design problems, like interesting things that you're thinking about if you break out of that thing. Jess, I also I lit up when you mentioned LARP, because I think that LARP, so live action role playing, is a oft sort of like, there's a group of people that like scoff at it, but I hate that. And I think it is a really interesting design space for people to look at. And I think that there's a continuum between RPG and LARP and more people should be looking at LARP. I just went to a murder mystery party. If you have ever went to a murder mystery party, you have played a LARP. And I think as we talk about non-traditional mechanics, I think some of these mechanics have a sense of being more like embodied. You're doing an action that's like uses more of your senses or takes more of you. You know, jukebox is an example of that. You're up and singing, which is like, you know, kind of bizarre. And so in LARP, you're usually fully acting out like your characters and the actions that you take in that and the senses that are kind of like, you know, triggered by things. I think there's a lot of exciting stuff going on there.
Yeah, I agree. I'm a LARP proselytizer. So there's a lot of really cool design happening in LARP. And I also am on the, if you're a game designer, go LARP, go play weird LARPs. There's a lot of really cool, I need to do an episode just on LARP again. We need to get Evan back on the podcast just to talk about LARP.
I look forward to your Jello LARP and your frog racing LARP. And
I like having a game where, I don't know, you close your eyes and you put your hand in and it's a bunch of Jello. That would be a really cool moment if you can figure out what, like.
I played that in elementary school. during little haunted houses your teacher would throw.
Yeah, and I guess this isn't a full thing, but like, yeah, people have said before, like, oh, is jukebox a LARP, or like, how much am I acting this out versus, you know, and I don't know, it's not a particular, like, it is sort of an interesting question to me, but I just don't have that, like, delineation. You know, like, jukebox was built on the bones of, like, you know, Dialect and Follow and some of these other scene-based games, which you would definitely say are role-playing games, I think. But because you sing a song in the middle of it, suddenly, like, people are like, oh, is this a LARP? You know, or there were some questions like that. So anyways, I think it's just further proof that it's like, it's a continuum. You know, there's no strict thing in the middle where it turns over into a LARP, in my humble opinion. Yeah, but I love me a gimmick. I love weird game design. I think that by giving yourself a challenge of designing with something other than dice or cards can really kind of crack your brain open to new experiences, and also just like getting experiences that are more true to whatever like emotional story thing that you're trying to hit. Like, not every story is going to be best experienced by rolling a 20-sided dice.
Lila, thank you so much for coming on the show. It has been a pleasure. Where can we learn more about you and find your stuff?
So I would say jarofeyes.com is my like portfolio website. It's a bit out of date, but it should always link to like the newest, you know, where to get jukebox things. If you just look jukebox up on itch, that is a full description of the game. You can get the PDF. It's actually sold out right now at IPR, which is a thing that I have to fix. But Plus One EXP carries it as, and soon Tabletop Bookshelf and Goose Poop Games will be carrying it as of, you know, GameholeCon, which I'm, you know, excited about. I am also doing a bunch of design with the Cosmere RPG. They certainly... Well, whatever. Yeah, buy their books. Like, I don't know. Buy my book over that because I'm going to get it more directly. But Cosmere RPG is made by a bunch of, like, really passionate folks. And specifically, like, I've led the teams that have written the adventures who are, like, lovely people. Our adventures are great. They get a ton of playtesting. So if you resonated with the playtesting part of it, or the Cosmere adventures get a bunch of it. Yeah, that's where you can find me, and that's what I'm working on.
You can find me on Blue Sky at Josca. I have a Kingsport Mysteries book for Arkham Horror RPG from Edge Studio, one of my freelancing adventures. I was really, really happy to work on this game with a group of, it's three adventures written by an all-femme team. Really, really cool for a game like that, and for a studio like that. Love the opportunity. That is the Kingsport Mysteries books for Arkham Horror.
And you can find me at Nerdburger Craig on Blue Sky, and the website is nerdburgergames.com. The games are there in the store, as well as at DriveThruRPG.
Thank you to our opening and closing theme song, which is Avil by Steph Sachs, licensed under Creative Commons. Thanks, Steph Sachs. And thank all of you for listening, and we'll see you back here next time. Bye.
Bye-bye.